All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show.
That's right. That's Outer National with Decisions. And there's a whole hell of a lot of decisions that have to be made, serious decisions these days. And we're going to be talking about some of them today.
At the back end of the show, we'll be hearing part of an interview that I did with journalist Lauren Markham. Lauren is also the author of The Faraway Brothers, which has been called an urgent chronicle of contemporary immigration. It's the story of twin brothers growing up in El Salvador in the wake of the Civil War, being forced to flee as unaccompanied minors and struggling to find a new life in the great American unknown. This is an urgent question today. The U.S. now has 10,000 troops stationed on its southern border, and almost every day, Trump and other fascists repeat racist lies about the refugee caravan from Central America, which is currently in Mexico. And this is in the context of the ethnic cleansing of immigrants that is being carried out by the Trump-Pence regime all over this country. Unfortunately, we're not going to have time for the entire interview on today's show, but you can definitely find it on my website, themichaelslateshow.com. Most of today's show is going to concentrate on a new speech by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. It's now online at revcom.us, and it's called Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. And joining me to talk about this is Annie Day, who is the director of the BA Institute, the Bob Avakian Institute. Annie, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. Hi.
Hi. Well, let's jump into it. We have a couple things we're going to play soon, but I wanted to ask you a couple questions first. And that's one thing is that, what is the film and what's it about?
So this summer, Bob Avakian, for people who don't know, Bob Avakian is the leader of the Movement for Revolution. He's the most radical revolutionary on the planet. And he's also developed a new synthesis of communism, a new communism that's aimed at the emancipation of all of humanity. So he gave a speech this summer in several cities, and the speech is now online. And it gets into, it's a two-part speech, and it gets into these questions: why we need an actual revolution, and how we can really make revolution. And in the first hour, he gets into, why is it? Is it the case that all of the horrors that we experience today that are enchaining humanity actually do flow from a system? And he gets into that with depth and heart. And in the second half, he walks through how, in a future revolutionary situation, what would it take to actually overthrow this system? What's the strategy for doing that? The strategy and the fighting doctrine for how the violent forces of this system could actually be defeated by a revolutionary people in their millions. And then he talks about how do we work to get to there? How do we work to get to that point? So there's really, in terms of identifying the problem and pointing towards and giving tremendous concrete guidance towards the real-world solution, there's nothing like this speech. And, you know, for people who really hate how we're forced to live under this system, who hate seeing the 7,000 migrants that are forced to flee their homelands, that are trekking through Mexico right now, and hate even more how they're vilified and demonized by the fascist rulers of this system. If you hate that, then there's answers for why we're in this situation and what to do about it in this speech. You know, you could go down the list of the horrors that are visited upon humanity right now. The fact that the scientists say we've got maybe 12 years left until the tipping point of no return in terms of our climate. If you are agonizing about that, then you need to see this speech.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that really, really struck me as I was just listening to it and re-listening to it in preparation for this, you know, the point that actually, one of the things that happens in this is that he really poses the reality of what's happening. Why, and it's a question for people, I think, in terms of that, what he poses. Why is this the state of humanity? And, you know, he paints a picture of the world as it is and how it can be and how it needs to be changed. And I think that's really important in terms of people understanding what's going on here, because we are living in a society that, I mean, I don't know that, we're living in a society that actually has the potential of destroying the entire planet, of massacring billions of people, you know, just in a flash. And it's sort of this kind of thing that keeps rolling along. We've got Nazis, you know, leading the government here. We've got all the stuff that they're doing around the world. And then in the midst of this is this speech. And I think it's really important in terms of what it says about what's the state of humanity, but also what needs to be done about it.
Yeah, I think both parts of that are really important. And I think a lot of times, one is, I think sometimes people get too used to living in such a nightmare, and really step back and think about what, you know, the half of humanity that females forced to suffer, what it means to be black and brown on a planet of in a country of rooted in such white supremacy, immigration, the climate change, the wars for empire. These are things people should not get used to. But then I also think, not to step over, which you spoke to, is really understanding why is all this happening? What is the source of the problem? And I think a lot of times people step over that diagnosis. Everyone knows it needs to change. Okay, but if you've got an illness, you got to do some work to diagnose that illness and the source of that. And that's the first half of this speech, as he goes very deeply and with a lot of heart and tremendous substance into how these outrages are really woven into this system of capitalism, imperialism. And why is it that nothing less, really nothing short of revolution, is gonna stop this? He makes the point in the speech that, look, we have two choices. Either live with all this and condemn future generations to the same or worse, if they have a future at all, or make revolution. And then that's what the speech answers, is why that's true and how to go at that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's extremely important, that piece. I was thinking about getting into that a little bit later as well and getting a little deeper into that. But I want to actually give people a chance to hear something from Bob Avakian on this. And you'll be able to stick around and continue the conversation, right?
Absolutely.
And we're going to run this for about 15 minutes. And I think it's at the very beginning of the film. And I think it's going to be something that people will really be taken by, and I think it's something we can talk about after we hear it.
Why we need an actual revolution and how we can really make revolution. This talk will elaborate on and go more deeply into what is set forth in How We Can Win, How We Can Really Make Revolution, a statement from the Revolutionary Communist Party, which provides a crucial guideline that should be taken up and acted on by everyone who hungers for and wants to be part of bringing into being a world without the horrors to which the masses of humanity are continually subjected. In line with that, in speaking here about what we need to be doing, I am not just talking about those of us who are already involved, but all those who need to become part of this revolution. This will consist of two parts. One, only an actual revolution can bring about the fundamental change that is needed. And two, how we can really make revolution. So let's get right into it. One, only an actual revolution can bring about the fundamental change that is needed. In 2012, in Revolution Nothing Less, I talked about the outrageous murder of Romarley Graham earlier that same year, shot down in his own house in the Bronx by the New York City police. He was only 18 years old. Do I have to tell you what race he was? His mother kept saying, "This has to stop." And his father repeated over and over, "Why did they kill my son? Why did they kill my son?" New York cops then loudly rallied around their fellow pig who murdered Romarley in cold blood, viciously taunting Romarley's family and loved ones, demonstrating yet one more time the ugly truth that in the way this country has been built, and for the powers that be in this country, the humanity of black people has never counted for anything. They have never been valued as human beings, but only as things to be exploited, oppressed, and repressed. 6 years later, and with cold-blooded murders by police continuing in an unbroken chain, I will say again now what I said then. How many more times does this have to happen? How many more times do the tears and the cries of anguish and anger have to pour forth from the wounded hearts of people? How many more times, when another of these outrageous murders is perpetrated by the police, do we have to hear those words that pour gasoline on the already burning wounds? Justifiable homicide, justified use of force by police. How many more? Ramarlee Graham, Nicholas Hayward Jr., Tamir Rice, Eric Garner, Darius Pinex, Oscar Grant, Manuel Diaz, Joel Acevedo, Laquan McDonald, Ayanna Stanley Jones, Sandra Bland, Jack Sun, Rennie Davis, Michael Brown, Freddie Gray, Maurice Granton, Harith Augustus. The list goes on and on and on. Thousands and thousands, especially Black and Latino and Native American. If this were the only thing wrong with this system, it would be more than enough reason to sweep it off the earth. But this is only part of the intolerable outrages that are continually perpetrated by this system and that cause so much unnecessary suffering for the masses of humanity. So let's go back to why and what it will take to make all the outrages really stop. Why are Black people, Latinos, and Native Americans subjected to genocidal persecution, mass incarceration, police brutality, and murder? Why is there the patriarchal degradation, dehumanization, and subjugation of all women everywhere, and oppression based on gender or sexual orientation? Why are there wars of empire, armies of occupation, and crimes against humanity? Why is there the demonization, criminalization, and deportations of immigrants and the militarization of the border? Why is the environment of our planet being destroyed? These are what we call the five stops, deep and defining contradictions of this system, with all the destruction and suffering they cause, which must be protested and resisted in a powerful way, with a real determination to stop them, but which can only be finally ended by putting an end to this system itself. Why, along with all this, do we live in a world where large parts of humanity live in stark poverty, with 2.3 billion people lacking even rudimentary toilets or latrines, and huge numbers suffering from preventable diseases, with millions of children dying every year from these diseases and from starvation, while 150 million children in the world are forced to engage in ruthlessly exploited child labor, and the whole world economy rests on a vast network of sweatshops employing large numbers of women who are regularly subjected to sexual harassment and assault. A world where 65 million refugees have been displaced by war, poverty, persecution, and the effects of global warming. Why is this the state of humanity? There is one fundamental reason. The basic nature of the system of capitalism, imperialism that we live under, and the way, because of its very nature, it continually perpetrates and perpetuates horror after horror. And in fundamental terms, we have two choices. Either live with all this and condemn future generations to the same or worse, if they have a future at all, or make revolution. But what is the scientific basis for saying that this system is the source of all this, that it is built into this system And therefore, it is impossible to do away with these outrages through reforming the system, and instead, it must be overthrown. Let's go back to those five stops. The oppression of black people and other people of color. This system in this country was founded in genocide and slavery. From the beginning, African Americans and Native Americans were treated as pariahs, a caste of people less than human and not deserving of the same rights and opportunities as the European settlers of the territory. White supremacy was poured into the foundation and into every institution of the country. The uniting of the United States was accomplished through the compromise written into the founding Constitution that institutionalized slavery. And for generations, slave labor produced a great part of the wealth of this country. As I said in Basics 1-1, there would be no United States as we now know it today without slavery. That is a simple and basic truth. And then, when it was no longer possible to contain the conflicts that had been somewhat held in check by the founding compromise, the Civil War erupted between the southern slave states and the northern states, which increasingly were based on the exploitation of wage labor by capitalists. But shortly after the end of this Civil War, another compromise was engineered, which was a continuation of the original compromise under the new conditions. The country was put back together on the basis of reaffirming and reinforcing white supremacy. With the masses of black people still overwhelmingly in the South, subjugated and terrorized into second-class citizen status, exploited in conditions of near slavery and sometimes still literal slavery by white plantation and other property owners. And the land and way of life of the native peoples was further stolen through armed conquest and decimated by slaughter, confinement in reservations, and cultural genocide, which has resulted in the poverty, oppression, and repression that continues to be inflicted on Native Americans to this day. Under slavery, it was the armed patrols and militias organized by the slave owners that hunted down slaves who rebelled or just tried to escape and terrorized the masses of black people as a whole. After slavery, with Jim Crow segregation, it was the Ku Klux Klan, together with local sheriffs, who largely played this role. Today, in the conditions in which masses of black people in the ghettos of the inner cities find themselves, the role that was played in the past by the slave patrols and then the Ku Klux Klan and local sheriffs is now carried out by heavily armed urban police forces. This is a big part of the overall role of the police, which, as I said in Basics 124, is not to serve and protect the people. It is to serve and protect the system that rules over the people, to enforce the relations of exploitation and oppression, the conditions of poverty, misery, and degradation into which the system has cast people and is determined to keep people in. The law and order the police are about, with all their brutality and murder, is the law and order that enforces all this oppression and madness. In the days of slavery, and then Jim Crow segregation after the Civil War, the oppressors viciously exploited and terrorized black people, brutally murdering those they saw as posing a threat or not staying in their place. But they did not kill off or incarcerate a huge part of the black population. because their labor was needed as a backbone and crucial source of profit for the cotton plantations and the overall economy in the South and the country as a whole. Today, with great numbers of black people concentrated in the inner cities, and with many factories and other capitalist enterprises having moved away from the urban cores, the police have killed thousands of black people in the last few decades, and they play a key part in forcibly maintaining masses of black people in a situation where, especially youth, robbed of any decent future under this system, are killing each other in the thousands, and millions are either incarcerated or in some other way under the control of the so-called justice system. Because white supremacy is such a defining part of this country, it is not just African Americans and Native Americans, but people of color generally who are subjected to discrimination, degradation, and brutality. And this applies now in acute ways to those whose roots lie in Mexico, El Salvador, and other parts of Central America and the Caribbean, which are tightly ensnared in a net of domination and exploitation by the imperialists of the USA, whose ravaging of these countries has driven many to emigrate to the U.S. itself. White supremacy and capitalism, they have been completely interwoven and tightly stitched together through the whole development of this country down to today. To attempt to really put an end to white supremacy while maintaining the system of capitalism would tear the entire fabric of the country apart. White supremacy and capitalism. It is not possible to overcome and finally abolish the one without overthrowing and finally abolishing the other.
All right, welcome back. And I want to move back to Annie Day. Annie, welcome back.
Thanks, Michael.
Sure. Let's talk about this because there's a lot that gets brought up in this, in what we were just listening to, you know, and there's something that's really unique about this, and it's actually true a lot of times, but I really felt pulled in this, you know, as I listened to this speech, you know, the fact that he brings us into the process of struggling to change all the suffering and all the stuff that's going on in the world. And with a very deep understanding, he gives us a very deep understanding of how things can be changed and how people can change once they understand what the system's about and what it's doing to the planet. And I think that's something that's really remarkable about his work, but also intensely necessary for today.
Yeah, look, I think that's true. This is a question that since the 1960s has been written off the agenda. You know, the word revolution has been reinterpreted to mean some kind of big change, reinterpreted to mean, you know, how you live your life on a personal level. It's just, it's come to be redefined and defanged. And what, you know, this speech does is it actually answers on the real what a revolution is. Why nothing short of an actual revolution will bring into being a different system, and then how to go at that. So in just in terms of, like, on the real, this speech does need to be heard. And on a whole different level, this speech actually can change everything in terms of bringing into being and cohering a revolutionary force that's applying what's laid out in this speech, in terms of the actual strategy for revolution.
You know, it's interesting, too, because it's actually something that both is for, you know, sometimes you think about there's people that have been around for a while and you think about, OK, these are people or people who have had basically settled into the way things were and have been, you know, there's an epidemic of people sort of not facing up to what the reality is in the world today and in particular in relation to this country. And this actually doesn't allow you to do that. It actually, and it doesn't sort of hit you over the head or wring your neck, but it actually brings out very scientifically and very thoroughly the importance of actually what needs to be done and what he's talking about there. It's extremely important, both for people who have been around on the planet for a while and for people, I think, especially too, for people who are younger and coming into things. I watched something on revcom.us on the website there, and I saw a lot of young people who were talking about the impact of this speech on them and what they were thinking about in relation to what needs to be done and what can be done in the world. Both in terms of getting rid of capitalism, but there's also an element of what it sets in terms of the state, you know, the question of what we're going to have after that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, like the speeches for it both can play a role in terms of it being at the center of organizing forces for an actual revolution, and being kind of the core guidance for that, for building up the forces that are working at building towards the time when we actually could have a go for power. And it can also change the terms of debate throughout society. You know, look, there's a lot of people who are just what you know are world weary and inured. I've been there, done that. I've been around a long time. Well, take the scales off your eyes and really talk about not getting used to what is, but how to really fundamentally change what is. And that's, you know, I think the speech, if people look at it with an open mind and critical thinking, you know, it really makes the case. People need to hear it. It puts something else out there. And there's nothing like Avakian in terms of both the work he does and the way in which he's able to deal with complex theory and strategy at a very high level, but also a connection with the most oppressed.
All right. And how can people find out more about the Bob Avakian Institute?
If people want to find out more about the Bob Avakian Institute, please go to our website, thebobavakianinstitute.org. We're always looking for volunteers and on people's questions and comments, so please look us up. And of course, revcom.us. So thanks for having me. And
thank you very much for doing this. And I'll talk to you again later. This is the Michael Slate Show, and I've been talking with Annie Day, the director of the Bob Avakian Institute. Now we're going to hear something more from the film. This is from the Q&A, and it's also available at revcom.us.
So my question is, what would be the next step if this regime consolidates power, the Trump-Pence regime?
Well, I think we're seeing, I mean, I'm not a fortune teller, I can't predict everything they do, but I think we get a good sense from what they're already doing. You know, clearly now you've got the Supreme Court, you know, where they already put another fascist on the Supreme Court to begin with, a Gorsuch guy. Now they've nominated another one so that they'll have like a, you know, and these Supreme Court nominations last people's lifetimes. So, you know, you're going to change that. So everything from a woman's right to, you know, to have an abortion, to things like gay marriage, to the giving more power to the police. I mean, you've seen what the line, you know, Trump goes to Long Island, right? Gives a talk to the police and says, don't, people complain you're, you know, that you're being brutal. Don't be so nice. When you put, I don't know if you saw this, but, you know, when you put somebody in a police car, basically smash their head against it. Don't cover, don't put your hand over their head and put him in. I mean, what, so this is, you know, going to, all these are the kind of things that are a necessary part of the way they're trying to transform the country. And basically what's happened is, like I made the point, that if you try to get rid of all this stuff, which we can sort of concentrate in the term white supremacy, for example, or male supremacy, if you try to get rid of those things within this system, you're going to tear the entire fabric of the country apart. And one of the you know, ways in which you can see that is that even the very limited and partial concessions that have been made are a big part of what has given rise to this whole fascist phenomenon of trying to basically destroy and reverse everything that's basically that's positive, even though limited, that has been achieved and been won through struggle since the end of the World War II, basically. Over the last 70 or 80 years, they're trying to get rid of all that. The make America great again means make America white again. It means, the way these people look at it, you know, is that everything was fine up, you know, and America was great. It was on top of the world up until, well, there are a number of things they say. Up until black people got uppity and said that they didn't want to live in these conditions anymore. Up until women said they didn't want. Do you know, this is an important thing. I mean, obviously, that it was only in the 1980s that the last state in this country, I believe it was North Carolina, actually made it so that raping your wife was not legal. In other words, up until the 1980s,
there were still states in this country where a man could legally rape his wife. And this goes back through the whole history of the country. So think about that for a minute. You know, that just sort of captures something in a very, you know, dramatic way. But, you know, the whole thing, women, you know, could not have bank accounts separately from their husbands. All this kind of stuff was what was brought under, you know, fire and struggled against coming off and out of World War II and through the 60s in particular. And, you know, and the whole gay phenomenon, I mean, think about that. You know, all these people who, you know, they look around and, you know, what the hell's happening? The whole country is going to hell, you know. And we have to get back to the way it was when it was great. In other words, get rid of all these things that have changed in a positive way, even though they're limited and they, like I said, they can't really deal with the whole problem. And, you know, they're angry about, the Vietnam War, the line that they've been sold, which they used to peddle back in the day, but it's gotten more out there now that we could have won the war, except we were betrayed by the politicians in Washington. See, we really were going to win the war in Vietnam, but the politicians in Washington wouldn't let us. I remember that William Westmoreland, who was one of the big commanders of the U.S. forces in Vietnam at the height of the Vietnam War, came back after they'd lost the war, basically, and made this speech and said, "We were winning the war in Vietnam, but we lost it in Berkeley." Now, having grown up in Berkeley, I was really excited by that. But, you know, that's a great thing, but it wasn't true. You know, I mean, people in Berkeley, sort of using that as a metaphor for all the protests around the country, did play an important role in opposing that war and contributed to the fact that the U.S. couldn't have won it, which it should not have. But it was, you know, the Vietnamese fighting in Vietnam and the whole international situation that was more, you know, the reason that they couldn't win that war. I don't have time to go into all that now. But the point I'm making is that, you know, you see, for a long time, all these veterans of the Vietnam War and in general veterans were sort of, you know, they were sort of like felt on the defensive, you know, and they weren't coming around because there was this whole movement of veterans, very good movement, Vietnam veterans against the war, you know. They had this whole thing where they had a demonstration of thousands in Washington, D.C., where they took their medals and threw them away on the steps and they said, "Next time we fight, it'll be to take these steps," and so on like this. So now all these, you know, all these veterans who were not coming from a good place, going all the way back to Vietnam, are coming out of the woodwork, and they got their veteran, you know, veteran of Vietnam hats. I wanted to get a hat that said "veteran" really big, of opposing imperialist wars. But anyway, this kind of stuff, and then there's the whole thing where, you know, there was the Atheist of America who went to the Supreme Court and won a decision in the early 60s that the schools could not promote religion. So now all of these people say, well, that's when it, you know, especially the Christian fundamentalists, that's when it all went to hell, is once they took God out of the schools. You know, and now these people, that's another thing you should understand, want a gut public education. Because they don't want public education, because they think public education indoctrinates people in secular humanism. So they don't want that secular humanism, you know. So they want, actually, they regard public schools as an enemy institution that should be destroyed and instead should be replaced by, you know, right now they're doing it with a lot of the, you know, home schooling. But their ultimate goal is basically to get religious schools. So, you know, all this is, if you look at all, you know, all these different elements, this is all what Trump, who originally was not really with all this stuff, he's always been a racist and a misogynist, male chauvinist pig, but he wasn't with all this fascist stuff. But at a certain point, his racism and his, you know, his male chauvinism pushed him in the direction of these fascist forces. And they sort of had a, you know, an unholy alliance, you know, where they're all of them are saying, well, you know, all this stuff about him and running around with prostitutes and, you know, and porn stars or whatever, you know, and Playboy bunnies. That was a different Trump, you know. Now, you know, now he's become, you know, he's gotten religion, you know. And you know, and I actually saw when remember that Access Hollywood tape came out, you know, grab him by the, you know. Well, I actually saw one of these women that was always on CNN, you know, sort of, they seem to have an army, if you'll pardon me for saying this, of blonde zombies. And you know, and she was one of those on there, and she had her cross on and everything. And when this came out, the Access tape, she says, "Well, I believe that Trump can be saved. We're all washed in the blood of Jesus. We're all sinners." You know, in other words, basically, never mind that, because he's doing all these fascist things that we want done, including promoting Christian fundamentalism, so we're going to ignore all this stuff. My point being, and to answer your question, I think you can see by all this, this is a very, you know, concerted program. All this is the stuff that they're going after. It has to do with knocking down even other ruling class forces and institutions that don't want to go to that, you know, in that particular direction, you know, like the media is the enemy of the people and so on and so forth. There's a so-called deep state, the intelligence institutions, including even the CIA and FBI, which are monstrously criminal, but they're not fully under the control of these forces. So they want to basically remake everything to implement this whole program. And then internationally, it's like any kind of agreement that doesn't, you know, that's been made is not good enough, because we have to become even more gangster-like. And whether it's economic agreements or military agreements, we have to become even more gangster-like in pushing our interests. So if you look at all this, people constantly, especially, you know, on, you watch MSNBC or CNN or listen to the Democrats, they always want to talk about as if Trump doesn't know what he's doing, or he's about ready to be brought down next Tuesday by Mueller's investigation or whatever. But they act like he's sort of like a joke almost, or, you know, like, okay, he's bad, but he's really incompetent. He's not going to be, and he's rolling along with the whole program. You know, look at all the stuff they're implementing. I mean, this thing that they're doing against immigrants, which is another big thing. See, these people are freaked out about the fact that if the current trends continue, the United States will no longer be a white majority country in population within another decade or so, or maybe two. They're freaked out about that. This country has to have the identity as white, Christian, male-dominated, etc. So, you know, this is the big push behind the anti-immigrant thing. And, you know, a lot, we have to also struggle with people about that. You know, you'll even hear people really oppressed, you know, you'll even hear black people say, oh, these immigrants are taking our jobs. What's taken your job, quote-unquote, is capitalism, not these immigrants, first of all. Second of all, you do not have a job. There is no job that has your name on it. You know, and like this was bequeathed to me by my grandfather. This, you know, this job for $8.25 an hour was my inheritance. No, you know, you work or don't work depending on whether the capitalists can make out on exploiting you. You know, and look, after World War I, a lot of black people came up from the South, and the capitalists did the same thing. They said, we can hire these desperately poor black people who've left everything behind in the South, and say white workers are on strike in St. Louis or something. We'll bring in all these black people to work there and then set up this whole thing where the white people will riot against them. And then, you know, I'll just say it like this. You know, here's these white people saying, these black people are taking our jobs. Here's an appeal to black people. You do not want to sound like white people, okay? You know? I mean, really, think about it. You know, yes, look, people, you know, what I mean. Look, people are desperate to get jobs and everything. Yes, that's true. But you should be joining with the other people who are being viciously exploited and impoverished the same way you are, instead of being played for suckers by being turned against people who are being exploited even more, which is the same thing they did to you, you know, to your grandparents or great-grandparents when they came from the South. You know, and now the other side of it is, All these people, oh, you know, these black people are lazy. Nobody in the history of this country has ever worked harder than black people, okay? Let's just, you know, not only in slavery, but, you know, 2-3 jobs coming up from the South, being exploited for generations, producing massive wealth, you know, and then getting pushed out because it's more profitable for the capitalists to go somewhere else or to bring in people who are even more desperate and exploit them and turn the oppressed against each other. And we got to struggle, people, to see that this is the nature of the system. This is what it does to people. This is what it's going to keep on doing to people until we get rid of it. And it doesn't have a decent future for you. I mean, which doesn't mean we shouldn't struggle now. We should. You know, people are poor, people are desperate, they can't raise their kids. You know, they can't, you know, they're working 2-3 jobs trying to, you know, take care of their family and finding it more and more difficult. Of course we should unite with people to struggle against that. You know, and to find a ways that people can, you know, not just survive, but, you know, not see their kids either go without health care or go without food or whatever. But we're not gonna get where we need to go if we get people who are basically fundamentally being messed over by the same system to be fighting each other, whether it's in the youth in the gangs or whether it's people who are fighting for the same jobs. We got to get people to see the larger picture and the deeper causes of this and then struggle to unite them to fight against the system. I mean, you know, look, something like McDonald's workers, you know, fighting for $15 an hour is not the answer, but it's something that should be supported. You know, because people do have to survive. And we can't just tell people, well, when the revolution comes, we'll solve all this. We have to pay attention to how people are suffering now and to waging struggle. But you have to do it in a way that's consistent with ultimately dealing with the whole problem and not in a way that turns the oppressed against each other. So going back to Trump, though, and all that, all these things are what they're doing. They're doing it right now. It's not just what they will do. They're doing it now. And if you want to know where they will go, listen to them talk, because they're pretty much telling you what they're doing. Listen to Pence, not just Trump. You know, and see what they're actually doing. Look through the fog. You know, penetrate beyond the fog that's being created on the news media to act like these people don't know what they're doing and aren't getting anywhere. They are moving on all these different fronts that I just talked about in a very concentrated way. And, you know, it's getting, the hour is getting later and later to be able to stop this. You know, and I've said elsewhere, people need to tell these people who don't, you know, really hate what Trump's about, but they go, oh, well, you know, we'll just wait for the Democratic blue wave or I can't see how taking to the streets would possibly accomplish anything, you know? When right around you in the world, you've had examples of people who forced out governments by taking to the streets, you know, in a number of different countries. And I can't imagine how we could get hundreds of thousands of people in the street. How many times in the last year and a half have you seen hundreds of thousands of people in the streets? Is that you don't want to take that step of putting it on the line to say this whole regime has to go. And people need to be told that that's morally bankrupt. And second of all, history is not going to look on you very kindly. If when you still had the chance, at least a fighting chance to stop this, you sat on your hands and did nothing. You know, like, I even heard one of these intelligence chiefs, I forget whether it was Hayden or Clapper, one of these people used to head up the National Intelligence or the NSA or whatever, saying, you know, making an analogy to Nazi Germany. And he was asked about it, and he said, well, I wouldn't compare the U.S. today under Trump to Germany in 1942, but I would compare it to Germany in 1933. Now, even a person in the ruling class is saying that. Listen up, all you liberals. You know, here's a person from the ruling class. And what was 1933? That was when Hitler was in power, started moving against all these other forces, but hadn't fully consolidated everything yet. And if people had moved against it then, they might have been able to prevent all the horrors that came afterward, including the, you know, the killing of the 6 million Jews in the concentration camps and everything else. Well, right now, you are in a position that's similar to Germany in 1933. And if you don't move to do something about it, then that whatever comes from that, which is not going to be good, it's going to be disastrous at least, and catastrophic possibly, that's on you too. Because, and I'm not just ranting here, I'm saying people need to be brought up against this. You know, that's on you too if you don't act now when you could have a chance to actually prevent all these horrors that you know somewhere are coming. You know, and get rid of your illusions that somehow the Democratic Party is going to do this or Mueller is going to do it. None of that's going to do anything in the absence of millions of people in the streets demanding that this whole thing has to go.
That was Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, from the Q&A that followed his recent talk, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution.
Oh yeah, oh la la, nah. Oh 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 nah, oh nah. A revolutionary dream, people listen keen. Freedom fight, I was my dream. I was on the...
All right, that was Revolutionary Dreams from Pablo Moses. Just a little while ago, a couple weeks ago, a friend called me and said, I have a book that you have got to read. And I got the book, read it, and immediately I had to actually get the author of this book on my show. And her name is Lauren Markham. She's the author of The Faraway Brothers, Two Young Migrants and the Making of an American Life, which has been called an urgent chronicle of contemporary immigration. I'm really pleased to welcome to the show now Lauren Markham, who is the author of the book. Lauren, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I have to tell you, as soon as I heard that recommendation and I started reading the book, I just couldn't stop. And it's really...
That means a lot.
Yeah. Well, it's something that really needs to be spoken to today. And especially in this climate that we're looking at, where you're going from everything from the dreamers to, you know, everything else that's happening. And you're looking at what's happening to people and the need for people to both understand it, but understand also... When you understand something or when you recognize something, there's a compulsion that you're faced with, too, about doing something about it. So I wanted you to start off giving people an idea of, well, give them a synopsis of the book, but also what its origins were.
Yeah, absolutely. So the book, many of us might remember the immigration crisis of the summer of 2014, the unaccompanied minor crisis. In the summer of 2014, the population of unaccompanied minors, and these are young people who've crossed into the United States without papers or parents. They're generally apprehended. The vast majority are generally apprehended very close to the border. And in 2014, that number skyrocketed. It had actually been almost doubling for several years, but in 2014, the government's sort of ability to house and feed and clothe and just kind of give very basic services to these young people was just overwhelmed. They should have known that the numbers would keep rising because they had been, but they didn't. They didn't prepare. So many of us might remember the kind of media blitz of that summer. And I had been writing about unaccompanied minors for a couple of years, kind of with this question of what happened, who are these young people? Why are they leaving? You know, anytime all of a sudden one particular demographic or a few, you know, in this case, young people from Central America start moving, like, we have to ask why. Why are these people moving? What are they leaving? Why are they coming to the U.S.? Why so many of them? I had these questions and they felt very urgent to me, and nothing I read sort of satisfied the answers I was looking for. And so I began interviewing young people and began writing about them for about this population and this changing dynamic for a couple of magazines. And then I decided that I was sort of never satisfied again. I kept wanting to write more and learn more. And so I decided to write a book. And so the book actually follows the story of two particular unaccompanied minors. The book is called The Faraway Brothers because in El Salvador, the euphemism for someone who's migrated away is hermano lejano or a faraway brother. So the particular faraway brothers I write about are Ernesto and Raul Flores. They come from a rural town in El Salvador, and they, like many unaccompanied minors, sort of end up on the wrong side of the gangs that have been rising in control and in brutality in the post-Civil War years in El Salvador, and they've gotten particularly bad. And the rise in gang violence tracks pretty much exactly with the rise in young people fleeing the country.
Now, tell me this, because one of the things when you talk about this, this is a big shift. I mean, the migration from the South that's been going on for a long time. But early on in your book, you do point to exactly what you're saying. There's been this significant change in the character of this. Now, what's happening with the older skilled people? What's leading to that change? What actually led to that change where you had the older skilled people who are either just desperately trying to eke out a continued existence there, or for a lot of them, just going home and not going back?
Yeah, well, so it used to be that the most common profile of migration of people coming into the United States from Central America and from Mexico, letting aside sort of in the post-war, like after the 80s, in the 80s, hundreds of thousands of people were coming here because there was a war going on, and a war that, by the way, in El Salvador, the United States was funding and supporting the government forces against the leftist guerrillas and government forces that perpetrated mass atrocities. So it used to be that the people who migrated for sort of economic reasons were economic migrants. They were coming to the United States. It was generally the father or the mother who was coming of a family, younger adults, but adults generally who had kids, who would come to the United States, get jobs, and send money home. In 2008 and around 2008 and after, with the economic crash in the United States, the number of adults crossing unauthorized into the United States began dropping, and significantly so. And at around 2011, the number of young people started growing. So there was a historical average of around 7,000 unaccompanied minors who were apprehended each year before 2011. This past year, there were 40,000. At the height, which was a couple of years ago, there were about 60,000 who crossed. So the profile really is changing. People aren't coming here for financial reasons anymore as much, although, of course, people still come to the United States for financial reasons. The main driver of the Central American exodus right now is violence. And young people are the ones who are recruited into the gangs. The vast majority of deaths and murders in the Central America's Northern Triangle, which is a region that includes Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, the vast majority of murders are young people. So young people are really at the front lines of this very strange and unconventional war, which is kind of a war between gangs and between gangs and the government.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit more, because this is something I was really intrigued by. And I mean, it's horrifying what's happening. And when you look at this thing of actually the gangs that form up in the, you know, gangs were not always the sort of the dominant force in these various countries, in whether it's, you know, whether it's in El Salvador or anywhere else. They weren't always the dominant force in terms of determining what's happening inside the society and what's going to happen in relation to, you know, people leaving or staying. What you're talking about is a very significant change that these gangs have come into it. And in some ways, I mean, even when I was reading your book, I kept thinking, okay, what's the relationship between the gangs and the army and what's going on here? And, you know, and you're actually looking at a whole new, where at one point in El Salvador, you were looking at this vicious regime, and then you're looking at the army coming in. And now, you know, from what you're saying, it's a lot like a lot of this is being taken up by these youth who were recruited as gang members and then actually became, this is how they make their living, and this is how they support their families. And this is sort of the way you do things now.
Yeah, or certainly it is an increasing force. And these gangs have grown in the wake of a brutal civil war. So you have generations of people who are deeply traumatized. It should be noted, and this is an oft-repeated fact, but at the same time, as much as I see it talked about and as much as I talk about it, it's always surprising to me how few people know this. But MS-13, this gang that is one of the main gangs in El Salvador, it's a gang that Trump and Sessions used to like to talk a lot about to sort of instrumentalize kind of hate and fear against immigrants. And there's sort of these accusations that these young people are bringing MS-13 into the United States, which is the vast majority of young people are fleeing these very same gangs. So in any case, MS-13 was born in Los Angeles during the Civil War among young Salvadorans who had, either without papers or some availing themselves of papers, come into the United States and were living in sort of poor urban neighborhoods and modeled their gangs after pre-existing gangs in the United States. And once those people were jailed and then sent back to El Salvador, they brought MS-13 with them. So the gang violence is actually an import of the United States. You know, that was like in the 90s when these gang members started being deported back, kind of post-war El Salvador. But they're really rising and growing in power in the context of a post-war society that has very limited economic opportunities. There are currently, in a country of 6 million, there are 300,000 young people who are not in school and out of work. The vast majority of young people don't go past the sixth grade. There aren't a lot of job opportunities for young people. And so there's this sort of repeated cycle of violence and of trauma coupled with the fact that the government is not providing the basic needs and services, right, that people want and need, like education and healthcare and jobs. So this is this sort of shadow economy that has become one of the dominant drivers in Salvadoran kind of politics and in the economy. And I should say that a lot of people do join gangs in order to, like you said, a lot of young people do join in for economic reasons and to be able to support their families, to support themselves. They also join out of, like, sometimes by force. They're told that if they don't join, they'll be killed or their mother will be raped. And sometimes they join for a sense of belonging. They might not have a family. But it's not like sometimes we have the idea of these gangsters being these sort of like flashy high rollers. And the reality is most gangsters, even the high level ones in El Salvador, are not living the high life. The living that they're eking out is still just scraping by. We're talking like a couple dollars a day.
That was journalist Lauren Markham, author of the book The Faraway Brothers. And you can hear the entire interview on my website, themichaelslateshow.com. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Annie Day and Lauren Markham. And I'd like to thank the people who worked on the show, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and engineer, Gary Baca. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. All right, we're going to go out now with Voice of Revolution from Savage Rose. Talk to you again next week. Some